Welcome to Voices on Art, the Van Horn Gallery podcast hosted by Daniela Steinfeld. This special episode is produced in collaboration with Independent Art Fair New York City. It will be part of the fair's OVR for its next edition from September 9 to 12, 2021. I'm Daniela, and this podcast is about my personal and also about a lot of other people's enthusiasm for art. Art can touch on all parts of life, and therefore we talk about all parts of life. I hope to get you on board and to tell you interesting stories you enjoy listening to. We're recording via the internet, so please excuse any glitches in sound quality. Episode 36, recorded June 12, 2021. My guest today is Latisha Fazakas, founder of the eponymous Gallery for Contemporary Indigenous Art in Vancouver, Canada, since 2013. Hi, Latisha. Very nice to have you.
Hi, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Latisha, before we start talking about your gallery, which we will do in depth, I'm really curious to get to know more about where you're coming from. What's your background? How did you first come in contact with art? And what was it in art that made you decide to make it such an important part of your life?
Oh, that's a really great question. My background is a very working class background. My family really was not part of the art. My father was a heavy duty mechanic and my mother was a homemaker. Mm-hmm. So we didn't talk about art or go and visit art galleries or anything like that when I was young. And I feel like life has a certain amount of destiny for everyone. And so I feel like I came to art as part of my destiny. And I had actually quit school as a teenager. Oh. And so I actually hadn't finished high school and I was working. I had children really young. I was a teenage mom and I was working. And, you know, from the surroundings, from like where I came from, that was like the biggest part of your aspiration was just, you just got employed and you worked and you lived your life. And there wasn't a higher level of thinking for education or anything like that. And I happened to be working one day and I realized as I was doing my job and I was doing it really efficiently. And I thought, you know, I wonder if I'm actually meant to do something else. I wonder if I should go to school and see what that's like. And honestly, I don't know why I suddenly felt encouraged to do that. I had no idea how I was going to do it. I had two small children and I went out and I was like, okay, well, I'm going to figure this out. So I quit my job and I took children in as daycare and I went back to school and I did distance courses at first. And I just started my education. I thought I really liked kids. And so I thought, well, maybe I'll be a teacher. Again, the end result has to be a specific job. So I was like, I will be a teacher and that will be great because I can be home with my kids. And I started university. I got through the first year and I was in the second year. And now it was time for me to like physically go to classes. I couldn't take any more online classes. I needed to physically go to school. And I had just a terrible registration date. Mm-hmm. And when I got there, there were three options left for me for my last class pick. And that was Russian, Spanish, or art history. And I have dyslexia, so languages really intimidate me. So I was like, I cannot do Russian or Spanish. There's just no way. Again, it was also at a time when I was extremely unsure of myself in so many ways. And I've grown so much since then. And so I thought, oh, I can't do languages. I know I just can't. I already struggle so much with writing. I write well eventually, but because of the dyslexia, it takes me longer. And so I thought, well, should I take this art history? And the person behind the counter at the registration desk was like, oh yes, you should definitely take this art history class. And I said, but I don't know anything about art. And he said, that's okay. That's okay. It's a first year. And I said, I don't know. I think you really should know something about art if you're going to take an art history class. He said, no. And I said, well, I'm going to come back. if this is a disaster, I'm coming. It really was.
Somebody wanted you to do that.
Somebody wanted me to do that. So I went to the class, and because I had no idea what I wanted to major in, and I really was a blank slate, I took a whole bunch of different kinds of classes. And so I was taking geography and sociology and psychology, and I finally found them all fascinating, but none of them clicked where it was like, ooh, would I want to like learn this for the rest mm-hmm. of my life? Is this something that could intrigue me forever? And I found them all interesting. And what art history made me realize was that I am that kind of person who wants to think about all of those things in a way. So I wanted to think about, you know, how your geography impacts you socially, politically, and all of these ideas. So suddenly all of these ideas and the way that I thought started to become justified for me. And I was like, I have found my place.
Wow.
And I thought, oh dear, what am I going to do with an art history degree? Again, I have two children at home. I need to have a job at the end of this. What do you do? And because I had completely no idea, I was like, what do you do with an art history degree? And so I thought, well, I'm going to have to teach art history. Mm-hmm. Oh, I'm going to need to get a PhD. Because again, I was on the teacher track. For someone who quit school, I actually really love learning. I felt like the school system really just did not accommodate and did not make me feel like I wanted to learn. There was a lack of actually enjoyment of learning until I took it upon myself to do my own self-learning. And then I got excited. So, and I found teachers and professors who were actually invested in and excited about their subject matter. And so that made a huge difference for me in my life. So I started on that. I was like, well, you know what? It's the only thing that I felt that I could fall in love with enough that I could be motivated enough to put in the extra effort because I needed a Herculean effort because I did have kids at home and I had all these other kind of stressors that I was like, I need like to feel incredibly passionate about something in order to learn it. And for me, art history just seemed to encapsulate all of the things that make life happen and examine where we are from and where we are going. And so it just opened up this whole way of like, always I was kind of deep in thought, but kind of to myself before. And I felt like I'd found my community.
Oh,
yeah. So I just followed the breadcrumbs essentially. And I went down the road and I was going to a community college. And then I transferred over to the University of British Columbia in Vancouver to finish my bachelor degree. Mm-hmm. And at that time, I started to realize a few things. One was, you know, it was going to take me a bit longer to get my bachelor's degree in the first place. And the other thing was that I really wasn't going to be able to afford the luxury of going on to doing a PhD. Mm-hmm. We were living very minimally throughout my bachelor's degree. And I thought, I don't think I could, you know, financially do this. I also was a little too social for that kind of academia. I felt a passion and a love for that. And I loved being around other people who were learning, but it seemed like I needed to rethink it. So I thought, well, what will I do for a job in the summer? And so I thought, well, maybe I should go since I'm doing this whole art thing, apparently. So maybe I should go and see if I could get a job in a gallery.
Oh, that's the link then, because I thought like, well, this is all Western art history, most probably what you studied. So how did you get to the indigenous art?
Exactly. And again, it was this connection with destiny because I had printed out my resumes. And again, I didn't know any gallerists. It wasn't like I had any connections and I was in a new city. I didn't know anybody in Vancouver. And so I literally started walking the street and finding galleries and walking in and leaving my resume. Mm-hmm. And I had walked into an Indigenous art gallery. And I had at that time very little experience with Indigenous art. And so I was like, oh dear, I don't know anything about this art. And so again, I'm also at that point in my life where I'm very easily intimidated by what I don't know. And I was about to turn around and walk right back out because I thought, oh, I got to get out of here. I don't know anything about this. And the woman who was in the gallery stopped me and said, oh, can I help you? Mm-hmm. And so I kind of sheepishly turned around and I was, you know, meekly, well, I have my resume. I just, you know, I didn't know what to say because I was trying to actually leave. And she was like, oh, here, I'll take your resume, leave it with me. And I was like, okay, but I really don't know anything about, you know, Indigenous art.
Yeah,
she's like, oh,
yeah.
That's okay. So she took my resume. And she was an Indigenous woman herself. And anyhow, I left and I didn't think anything too much about it.
Yeah.
And at the time, I had just finished taking one course that was a broad course on Indigenous art. And I had like dipped my toe in, but it was very, very broad and very generic. I didn't know a lot. And I certainly did not feel like I knew anything really. And I had just happened, though, to have done this paper. And this paper actually ends up the next kind of link for me to where I'm supposed to go, because I get called in for an interview at this Indigenous art gallery. And I sit down with the owner, and then he sends in one of his staff members to see if, you know, we're all going to mix and do well together. And and he's telling me that he's just finished his master's degree at UBC as well. And he did his degree in anthropology. And I said, well, that's really fascinating, because I just did this paper. And what is your last name? And we both said Blair at the same time. I had written a paper that was highly researched through his master's paper for my thesis. And it was like, I read your paper. He's like, that's crazy. Like, I know. So I left going, well, I think I have that job.
It was just naturally falling in place.
It was naturally falling in place. And so I arrived there and I started working there, and I worked there a couple of summers, and then I graduated and then I came on full time. And again, I was incredibly frustrated, though, with what I did learn at school with regards to Indigenous art. I still felt like it was a great lack of knowledge. And what was beautiful about it, though, is that I learned from the artists themselves. And so I learned from the people whose works and culture and lives this came from. And that made a huge difference. I am extremely grateful for that, because it's a completely different way of learning than someone telling you about other people and what they are. It is a way of learning the culture from the culture still living and breathing and being alive, as opposed to on the shelf and in the drawers and locked away somewhere. It was, this is where it came from. And it was about family relationship and, you know, ancestry and such a connection to the land that we lived on. And for me, that was just so enriching that I just continued to kind of fall in love with it. And then one of my other coworkers, and this is 20 years ago now, so you have to remember that as well. Like, the world has changed a lot in the last 5 years, but 20 years ago, Indigenous art, and specifically it was a Northwest Coast Indigenous art, which is also important to point out that all Indigenous art is not the same, and it just is completely different. As
Each culture is different, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. From any country and so on, and culture for sure. So in that, one of my coworkers one day, and we were having a discussion, and he said, well, you can't put the same social commentary onto this work. You know, you can't examine it within the dialogue of Western art history.
Yeah, that would be so interesting for me. What's the difference?
I think that that was partly because he grew up with Western art and Western art history. And even though he knew a lot about the culture, it was still, he was coming from a different direction. I was still, for the most part, really a blank slate. I had no preconceived notions. everything that I was learning in art history was like a completely new thing. And it was like, oh, and I can apply it to this, and I can apply it to this. And so it didn't occur to me that I couldn't apply.
Oh, so you didn't make a difference.
No, I can include it as something that is just as examinable. Because for me, art history and that discussion and discourse was really about life.
Yes.
It was the physical manifestation of all of these, like, accumulation of studies. It was psychological, it was social, it was historical, it was contemporary, it was all of those things coalescing. So why wouldn't it be able to examine the work that was before me? It has a history. It has geography involved in it. There's sociology. There's social disruption. There's definitely politics involved. So for me, it was like, well, all of this stuff, the fact that it's still being made and that there's all this resilience and this protest to kind of to continue on, like there just was so much. I was like, if anything, this is the most exciting thing to look at because no one has examined it for 100 years in that way. It had been examined in an anthropological way, in a way of keeping it in history rather than still alive and still breathing.
And not as contemporary culture and not as contemporary art.
Exactly. And I was like, it's not, like, it's still here and it's here in a most interesting way. And there's so much to learn from it. You know, we're learning all the time. We're changing our opinions all the time. Like, why would we relegate? And again, I think partly too, because of my background, because I always felt like the underdog for most of my life.
And you didn't have preconceptions, you know, you didn't have preconceptions.
Exactly.
As you said, you were a blank slate, so you didn't have prejudices also.
Yeah, it didn't occur to me that this work was not, you know, worthy of being at the highest level as anything else. And when I felt like it was being discounted, I started to kind of feel a bit protective of it. I was like, hey, don't discount this. I was like, I was perceived as, you know, being discounted. Look where I've got. I'm still here and I'm still moving in the world and I'm still accomplishing things. You know, it just kind of ignited this rebelliousness in me.
So the underdog loves the underdog.
Yeah. To me, in a way, it wasn't that the artwork was an underdog. It was that it was being perceived as that. I'm always thinking, I'm constantly thinking, what is art? What is the definition? Because again, I'm always learning and there's always these different things that you discover or you encounter that are in an art gallery or in an art setting. And so I'm always wondering, well, what is it? Like, how do you define it? Especially to people who aren't involved in it, or even people who are involved in it, actually. It's just always this elusive thing. Like, what exactly is the definition of art? And I realized one day that it is the act of creation. And whatever that is, creating whatever that is, that can be creating a song, creating a meal, creating a life. All of those things are art.
Art is the act of creation.
Art really is the act of creation. The Northwest Coast particularly is the most incredibly established and important. There was so much bounty here. Culture was able to develop and stratify. And so you see grand monument and you see there being levels, you know, levels of expertise and levels of importance. And, you know, there was a nobility and there was a middle class and there was a lower class within the culture. And so there was high art, there was high culture, and people were participating in high culture here. And to me, that just seemed so fascinating that, and it also seemed like, oh, this is something that nobody else is doing. I also didn't like doing what everybody else was doing.
So you worked there for 11 years.
Yeah.
And then at some point you decided to found your own galleries on the foundation of what you just told me.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So I had gained knowledge and insight and I had gained relationships with the artists. And in particular, I'd started a friendship with Bo Dick, who would be the next breadcrumb on my journey, because I felt like he was an incredible artist in and of himself without needing to be the most incredible artist within his niche. I just thought he was the most fascinating artist in Canada and maybe even the world.
And you have to explain a bit about Bo Dick. He was this artist, but also a chief.
Yes. Well, Bo was many things, and he was very magical. And there was something about him that just sang destiny and sang next level, and that he was meant to do something. So he's a Kwakwaka'wakw person from Kingcum Inlet, which is on the coast. And that is a very complicated cultural group that has something called winter ceremonies that people like to now call potlatches. But it was a very sophisticated group of ceremonies that required a great deal of masks and regalias and
performance.
And he was a very big activist, not only for his people and towards Canada and the world, but also within his culture. He was supporting very much keeping it alive and keeping ceremony going within his culture. And because of that, he basically rose to a chief. He created an interesting kind of economics that utilized the capitalism that was forced upon them to foster back into the existing economic system, which is the potlatch system, the ceremonial system. And so he acted as a chief in that he would gain resources. Before, it used to be through harvesting and things like that in the ocean and the land. And he would gain resources through selling his artwork. And he would utilize those resources to perform these ceremonies and performances and livelihoods of those within his culture. He would utilize the money that he made to pay artists to learn to carve and create so that they could create these pieces that then could be used within a cultural context.
So he was supporting his community.
He was very much so. And in a very innovative way, because there was so much pressure, like overt and aggressive pressure, to do away with how things were done before, to do away with the history. And, you know, we all today, even in Western culture, struggle with the pressure of consumerism and capitalism and, following that and getting caught up in it. You know, I think a lot of us feel like we're tumbling around in it, and it's so easy to get into the frenzy of consuming. And I think that, imagine that if you also are trying to keep alive a completely different way of doing things within a culture that has such pressure on it to be eliminated.
I would like to know, really, because that is such a complex theme, so we can just cover it kind of like in a nutshell, but what is Indigenous art, which is labeled still as Indigenous art, and then we have contemporary Indigenous art. So there must have been inside that culture also development, like in the Western culture as well, that artists, some do this, and then the next generation comes and they do something differently. Is that the same also for Indigenous art?
Absolutely. And I think that was where Bo's work really was emblematic of that, is, and the uniqueness of the coast again, is that it has its own art history. Just like, you know, we in Western culture follow a art history that meanders through all sorts of different places and purposes for art. Well, on the coast here, you know, there's hundreds and thousands of years of material production. And we forget that art for art's sake didn't happen thousands of years ago.
No, absolutely. It's pretty young.
Exactly. And so there is a long history of making of things like masks and things like that, and totem poles and regalia and things like that. And there's always been change and evolution. And at some point there becomes contact and colonialism, and that changes You could follow those changes within following the artwork and its trajectory through time as well. And you see the influences of Western art. Mm. And then, you know, you end up today. And whether someone's creating something that people would label traditional or kind of more anthropological or not, it still is contemporary. And I think the beauty of it is that you can still find a way to include it in contemporary art regardless.
It's a lot about that, yeah, a lot about inclusion. I think you met the motivation to found your own gallery, which I can hear in what you're saying, is very much founded in all these insights you have, where you said, mm-hmm. oh, I want this to be part of contemporary culture, and I want to be part of communicating this mm-hmm. and being inclusive. So when exactly did you found your own gallery, and also how did you decide, or how do you still decide which artists find a place in your gallery? You have a little bit more about a fluid business model, which is different and probably not fitting into any capitalistic definition, as you said yourself. How did all of this came about?
Yeah, again, it really came about as destiny. So about 2011, I left the gallery I was working at and I took some time. Mm-hmm. I had managed to save up some money and I thought, what am I going to do? So I'd started a documentary film on BoJack.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that was like another story. Again, it was destiny. I'd met some people who were in the film industry. They gave me the idea and I started to run with it. And I was naive enough not to know.
God, you're so self-taught in everything. I mean, I admire that.
I was like, how hard could a documentary film?
Yeah, whatever. I did it all.
Well, I guess
already.
I'll find out.
I raised some kids.
Meanwhile, raising some kids, yes. Yeah, so I had left and I wasn't sure if I was going to start my own gallery. I thought, well, maybe I'll do some consulting and I'll maybe do some, you know, projects and maybe that will facilitate my economic need. And I think that's it. Like, I am the kind of person who does follow where kind of the universe is leading me. And I have a very heartfelt desire to create and be part of a world that is more inclusive and that does care more and that does have more profound meaning in it. And I thought, you know, my dad died at a very young age. He died at 51. It was around the time I went back to university. Mm. Although my dad and my mom had separated when I was quite young. And so I had been kind of on my own since really I was like 15. But my dad passing away made me think life is really short. Mm. You don't know how much time you have here. So you should do something really interesting and satisfying mm-hmm. while you're yeah. here. And so that always has been part of it. And it kind of also like tugged away at, like, again, I have economic needs.
Sure, we all have.
I think that that's also too why I was so attracted to Bo and his work and how he learned to relax that economic insecurity so that it was like, okay, you know what? I actually really don't need that much to be okay. And I need other things and other fulfillment in order to be okay. And that is learning and experiencing and connecting with other people and creating. I think that everyone has a responsibility that the life that we're given is such a treasure that what we should be doing with it is to do as best we can our best work to make the world a little bit better by the time we are done.
Leticia, you are a teacher. You're pretty clear about that, huh?
Yeah, so I ended up on that trajectory and with that mindset. And so the things came together and it was pretty obvious about a year later, 2012, that I needed to work towards opening up my own gallery. And so by the September of 2013, I opened up my own gallery with the explicit idea of creating a space in where Northwest Coast Indigenous art would be part of the conversation.
Yeah.
Because I really did love art history. I really did love all of those theories and discussions that went on in it, I just didn't want it to not have a space for the people who I'd begun to care about quite deeply. And I thought, like, just even intellectually, not just with my heart, but intellectually, I thought belonged, had something really beautiful to offer the discussion, that the discussion would be better off with the inclusion of these people rather than, you know, these people being better off because they were allowed in.
Yeah.
You know, that actually there's quite a beautiful contribution. And so I started the gallery and I still worked on the documentary film about Bo, and it all just kind of became part of it. So it was a living, breathing, connecting with other people. And that's where I met most of my artists, is through those different connections. Bo would bring me artists that he'd be like, oh, you should look at this person's work. And he was also a very eclectic person who appreciated different types of art. He loved Caravaggio and actually did mass based on that kind of same shadowing and foreboding and moodiness of the lighting in Caravaggio. He created that in that. So every artist that I work with, there's an individual relationship. And so we work our business dealings based on those individual needs for both of us. And so it is quite fluid, and it is as individualistic as we can. And I think, as every dealer does, you know, we believe very wholeheartedly in these people that we represent. Otherwise, we wouldn't be putting all of our effort and resources into them, because we do it because we believe in them. And that's how I feel about the artists that I work with, is I believe very, very strongly that they have a wonderful contribution.
Absolutely. I mean, you said that relationships can be more humane and better for business at the same time.
Absolutely.
And do you think the art world as a whole can learn something from these more fluid relations, and also learn something for this challenging times and changing times we're just in?
Absolutely. And I think that it's really quite important, because I feel like doing things differently than that is doing things out of fear. And I get caught up in it as well. There's plenty of times where I get like, oh, you know, fear of economic demise. And what I have to remember is that, you know, I was smart enough to get here. When the next challenge, or if something does demise, I should be able, smart enough and creative enough, to find a new path that leads somewhere else. And that's just happens to be where I need to be next. And one of the other things that is quite beautiful, again, you know, Bo has just always been such a big part of my life, is that Bo's work financially still does very, very well. And his work still does support those other artists. So he's the strongest financial artist that I have in the gallery. And that supports me being able to take on other artists that I'm interested in and that I feel like are worthy of support, that might not have the same economic benefit to the gallery. They have a different benefit.
So he still supports the community even after his death.
Yes, absolutely.
Mm. You founded your gallery, which is going on since 2013. And how was that then perceived? Because you have a foot in each of the worlds, in the contemporary art world, in art history, in the so-called indigenous art world. So how was that perceived? What is your collector base? How did you go about that?
First, it was quite clumsy. Also, there are two very different business models. A typical gallery, you know, has artists that they represent and they're exclusive and the works are on consignment, whereas specifically Northwest Coast has a history of a retail model. So since the kind of 1970s, 80s, even before that really, but there's this idea of selling the goods, and then the goods get sold to a market that collects that need.
Well, it's a dealer model.
Yeah, like it's very, very much so. So I had to kind of create this hybridity and in a world that really didn't understand it. And I definitely had the first couple of years, people kind of going, I don't like what, you know, you're not one or the other. And I had kind of skepticism from both sides. So it took a while for that to really take off. And I would say the first 4.5 years were really awkward, you know, starting off with not a lot of money. I couldn't buy a lot of work.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. That's a good thing in the consignment or commission model.
Exactly. It was very good because you spend your resources on other things and it's not tied up in physical work.
Mm.
At the same time, I have two different competing models and I kind of double my competition in a way. And yet I create my own unique niche.
Yeah.
So I'm competing with Western art models and those galleries that are doing that. But I'm also competing with the Northwest Coast dealer model on the other hand, which is the more retail based. And so they've got large stock essentially in their galleries. You know, they have $1 million worth of artwork to showcase, whereas I'm doing it piece by piece, a little bit here, a little bit there, you know, when I could find good works. And I already had relationships with all of the artists. And because I had those relationships and because those artists saw my vision, they supported me.
Mm-hmm. They understood that this could also be changed.
Exactly. And they wanted to, you know, Randy Cook, Cole Speck, Bo Dick, so many artists were like, okay, you know what? What we're going to do with your gallery is we can see the value in this. Let's work our own model out that works for both of us. Basically, at the beginning, to work with me was not as economically advantageous. They needed to take a chance on me too.
It was a risk.
Exactly. And they needed to put their money and their livelihoods behind it as well. And so that's how we created what the gallery is today, is this mutual support.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I think that it's become, you know, very beautiful. And I also was at the place where I got to beautifully see the change where the world started to go, wait a minute, okay, Indigenous art has something to contribute here. And so there are all these different players came in at a beautiful time to start advocating, and more voices started to go in the same direction that I'd been wanting to go and I'd been trying to go for 20 years. And I'm sure a lot of them had been doing it for 20 years. You know, Candace Hopp came onto the scene as an incredible curator that broke down barriers. And that's how Bo ended up at Documenta. And she could see the vision. I felt like a kindred spirit right there because I felt like she understood and she was so able to beautifully articulate exactly how I felt about not just Bo's work, but the work in general. And Bo was so beautifully emblematic of that. He has been always this wonderful bridge between worlds. You don't need to segregate Indigenous people. You don't need to segregate the spiritual world and the physical world so much. You know, the spirit world is around us at all times. And I think that's also part of what his practice showed us, is that there aren't these black and white answers. Things aren't as separate as we think they are.
No, not at all. And also, I think right now might be exactly the right time to bridge those worlds, you know, to bring it together.
Absolutely.
And so as a last question, I would like to know, what will you be showing at Independent in September? And also, what are you expecting or looking forward?
Well, you know, I am looking forward to actually being able to leave the country, or province even, or city. I feel very kindred to New York as well. There's something about New York that really is magical too. So I'm excited about that. I'm excited about the relationships that I found in the Independent Art Fair and how I think caring that team is about art and the world and voices that are important and galleries who do things differently and with care. I'm looking forward to seeing all of those people again. And I'm also really excited about the voices that I'm bringing. I am bringing Randy Cook, who is also Kwok Kwok Ewok like Bo, who is exquisitely formally trained in Kwok Walkie Walk artistic endeavors or skills. So he has incredible techniques within what you would call traditional form. And he's become such an expert in that, in things like, and this might be foreign for other people, but it's called form line, which is a way of creating two-dimensional painterly works. And he's an expert at carving. And so he has these beautiful technical skills, and he's honed them so wonderfully that he's now able to extrapolate and utilize the influences from the contemporary world in his work and collaborate with those things in a really beautiful and unique way. He's done some glass works as well as sandblasting and using like automotive paint. And then I'm bringing Audie Murray, who is Métis, and she's from my home province of Saskatchewan and my home city. I was born in Regina, Saskatchewan, and that's where she's from. And her work is multimedia as well, like many, many different types of mediums does she use. She does a lot of beading as well as kind of utilizing lyrics and poetry in her work. She's rendered ink out of nuts. And I think she's going to do a few pieces with that ink. Initially, we were going to do Nada House last year before the world closed down. And Nada House is on Governor's Island. And Governor's Island used to be called Nut Island by the Lenape people who are from there, because nuts grew there so plentifully. And so we thought we'd do a nod to that place and that sense of place, given the place in which the independent will take place this year in the ferry terminal, which there's a ferry that goes back and forth from that island that goes out of that building. And so we were also wanting to include the sense of place. That's a big part of Indigenous artist practice, where you come from and how many generations and generations. North Americans, we always look back through our past to like, oh, well, you know, what are you? I'm Hungarian because my family is from generations ago, where that's the nationality that they were. But when you come to Canada, we have people like Indigenous artists that this is their sense of place. And so bringing up that subject matter is incredibly important. And I think it's a wonderful thing to be able to do. So I'm excited about Audie's work. And then the last, but definitely not least, is Marcy Friesen, who is Swampy Cree from Herit River, Saskatchewan. And she deals primarily with beading. She's actually incredibly talented, dexterous moccasin and love maker and beader, who has such a wonderful new voice to add to the conversation. And she has not been formally trained in art whatsoever, and she is just naturally a genius. And I am so excited about her. She just started doing art last year. She'd been making things for youth for decades. And Carrot River is quite remote. She lives on a farm in Carrot River. And the closest city is Saskatoon. And Saskatoon is by far a very small city. So she went to the Remy Modern there about a year and a half ago before COVID hit, and was fascinated with this thing called art. She just was blown away. She was bringing things to their gift shop because she makes these things that are very utilitarian. And she was like, it all seems so useless. I love it. Like, people are making all of these things. Yeah,
that's the great thing about art. It's so useless.
It's so useless. So she uses that term all the time, but in a different, you know, in a different way.
In She's a good like, way. No, I completely understand what she means.
Exactly. She was like, I'm going to go home and make useless things.
Oh, lovely. That's so lovely.
And so she started making just one moccasin, and she started beading the inside of the moccasin.
She was really inspired.
She was really inspired. And I saw her work on Instagram. She did this beautiful beaded mask in isolation from COVID. And I saw it on Instagram, and I contacted her, and I was like, wow, this is amazing. We kind of started a conversation, and we started a relationship from there. And I thought, not only was she so incredibly talented, But I felt another kindred spirit, and I felt I met someone who naturally was meant to do this. And I was meant to meet her, and I was meant to show other people this incredible woman. I'm just excited about all three of these artists and for people to see what they're doing and why they're doing it and how innovative it all is and how it still is connected to an art history that does not start in Rome or Greece or the like.
Mm. Letitia, you're definitely a genius in promoting your artists, I can tell you. And I'm learning here. I'm learning a lot.
Oh, thank you.
So what are your plans for the gallery, except going to independent for sure, for the near future after COVID?
So the near future is actually to move into a larger space. We need a bigger space because we have ambitions to do very exciting things. So we were, again, blessed that we made a connection with a collector who is also involved in making of things and has a space that will be available to us in the new year. And so we will be moving into that space. And it's part of like a community connection, essentially, a community of art lover connection that is going to allow us to do this, which I'm very excited. It's about 3,000 square feet. So it's about four times our size.
Right. So community is really very important. And thank you so much, Letitia, for sharing all of this with me. It's super interesting. And hope to talk to you again soon.
Thank you.
This was a special Voices on Art episode created in collaboration with Independent Art Fair New York. Listen to it on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or the platform of your choice, on our website van-horn.net, and from September on in the Independent OVR at independenthq.com. Follow Independent Art Fair on Instagram at independent_HQ and the podcast at Voices on Art and at van_horn_Düsseldorf. Thank you for listening to Voices on Art, the Van Horn Gallery podcast hosted by Daniela Steinfeld. Stay tuned and connect.